All electric all the time. That's GM's goal, at least. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today, the 8th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I spent some time in Warren, Michigan earlier this week, 15, 20 miles north of Detroit. It's an industry town mostly, that industry being cars and more specifically General Motors. GM is the biggest, as measured by sales, of what used to be called Detroit's Big Three car makers, and it has promised to make 100% of its cars emissions-free by 2035, which explains how I wound up on Tuesday morning at GM's Global Technical Center in Warren. It's a huge campus. 25,000 people work there. The heart, really, of the research going into GM's electric vehicle offerings.
Hi. How are you? Kai Rizdal, nice to see you. How are you?
That's Mary Barra. She is the chair and CEO of GM.
And you're in our R&D building, which is one of our historic Saarinen design buildings. The stairwell, you wouldn't be able to make anymore.
We were commenting on it on the way up here.
And then we got to it.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks so much for making the trip to Warren.
And it was a trip. Warren's an interesting place. We drove in this morning, and I was thinking about how I was going to start our chat. And I was looking at the cars as I came in. Lots of, you know, almost all GMs. Not all of them, but almost. It occurred to me, though, that there was only one EV in the whole parking lot. And it's the one parked out front. It's your new Cadillac Lyriq. And I guess my question is, how do you get America into driving EVs when you don't, it looks like, have a lot of GM workers driving EVs yet?
Well, I think it's a great question, and it's coming. You know, this is kind of a breakthrough year for General Motors. You know, by the end of this year, we'll have 9 EVs available, you know, with the Bolt EV and EUV all the way to the Silverado EV that we launch in, you know, short order. We'll have a very affordable Chevrolet Equinox EV, a Blazer EV, and then also when we look at the Lyriq that's just ramping up. And so for General Motors, you know, we made the decision to do a dedicated platform, which we call Ultium. And so the Bolt is our second generation technology, but Ultium is our third generation. And this is the year we really ramp those up. So I know there's a lot of our employees who want, in fact, I just came from a town hall where they were asking, how do I get more experience to understand, you know, how an EV changes my life? And that's the journey that we're on. So if you came here in a year, it would be much different.
So maybe we will. But look, you're discontinuing the Bolt and you've got all these cars planned. How many are coming out the door every year, right? I guess the question is, are enough coming out the door?
I wish I had more. So to your point, I absolutely wish I had more. You know, we'll make about 50,000 for North America by the end of end of this month.
Which is a single-digit percentage of your production, right?
Exactly. But we will then virtually double that in the second half of the year. And we are still on track by middle of next year to have made 400,000 EVs from 22, 23 in the first half of 24. But then it just ramps because we've said and we've got the plans in place to reach 1 million EVs in 2025.
That's a big swing.
Huge swing. And this is the year.
Okay. Were you late? Did you miss the boat?
You know, what I would say is we made a decision. We were actually early when you think about the Bolt EV,
truly
affordable EV. And when we started to work on what was going to come after the Bolt EV and EUV, that's when we realized really to do it efficiently and to really be able to scale, we needed a dedicated platform. And so that's why we created Ultium. We also decided we weren't going to do a half step. We weren't going to go to a lot of hybrids because really in a hybrid, your vehicle has two propulsion platforms. You've got the internal combustion engine and the battery. And we made the decision we were going to go to the end game and then making our own batteries. And so we have a plant that's now ramping up very well in Ohio. We have another one in Spring Hill, Tennessee that will ramp up by the end of the year. Another one coming online next year in Michigan. So I think the decision we made to do a dedicated platform and to make our own battery cells, that ramp up has taken a little while.
I'm going to talk platform in a minute, right? Because that's important for what you're trying to do. I do want to talk about affordability, though. You did a conference the other day in which you said it's not possible, really, right now with the technology we have, to make a $30,000, $40,000-ish EV and make money on it. So how are you going to make money? Because that's your job.
Yes. Well, part of it is battery breakthroughs. And as we look at our platform, we have committed with all the ramp up and investment we're doing in 2025 will be to single mid-digit levels of profitability.
Right.
And we believe with the work that we're doing on battery technology and then the fact that we're going to leverage and scale our Ultium platform as well as making batteries internally, that will give us a lot of advantage to get to profitability at the lower levels. But that's why at this current juncture, IRA is very important.
We'll get to the IRA as well, right? And the infrastructure part of this, because that's huge because you're depending on a whole lot of other things happening, as are all EV makers. Super quickly on the Ultium platform. It is basically a combination of drivetrain and battery technology, right? And that's what you're betting the ranch on here.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, it is. And what's important about the Ultium is it's scalable because when we start with a clean sheet of paper and say, what do we want the next Chevrolet Equinox to be? We decide by how many battery cells and modules we put into the vehicle, what the power and performance and range is going to be of that vehicle. And then we can scale it. But what's the beauty of the platform is it's chemistry agnostic. So we can use pouch, we can use prismatic, we can use cylindrical cells. We also have a wireless battery control system that allows it to be much faster to get that vehicle up and running. So we really dedicated the work on Ultium to make it not for today's technology, because the technology is and has to change, but to make it scalable so we don't have to redo the capital as we go forward.
I don't want to get too sideways here, but since you're bringing out all the technical terms about battery science, which is a huge part of what EV makers are trying to do. You're an electrical engineer by training.
Yes.
Does that help you now in this juncture as you try to transform this company?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I haven't done, I'll say core engineering in a while in my career, but, you know, it always goes back to first principles. And so I think being able to lead the company and really understand, you know, what we're doing from how we design, and I actually had the privilege of leading product development in my career, so really understand how that works. I've had the opportunity to run an assembly plant in my career as well. And having that core knowledge of what it takes to build a vehicle safely, with high quality, and very efficiently is something that I've grown up in the environment and know how to drive the organization to accomplish.
So you have used, in the eight-ish or so minutes we've been talking, you've used the phrase ramp, and to emphasize that you've done the hand going up a ramp signal here. It seems like you're counting on ramping as the savior here, right? You need to scale.
Well, definitely. And that's always been our plan. And again, we know how to do that. But when I look at the strong response that we have to the Lyriq, which I just took delivery of mine the other day and just talked to an employee who was driving a Lyriq and talked about how, you know, it's just a fabulous vehicle. The Silverado.
It's funny that you had to wait, but somebody working for you got theirs first. I'm just saying.
Well, but that's by design too, because, you know, when we're launching a new vehicle, I want those vehicles in the hands of engineers who can ensure that we've designed and met all our goals. And then frankly, for the first customers, the hand raisers, I want them to get their vehicle too. So I've been driving a Bolt EUV for several months before that. Absolutely love it.
So why are you stopping making it?
Because it's our second generation technology. And we're moving Ultium. The difference between our second generation and third generation, which is Ultium, is a 40% reduction in battery costs. And we're leveraging the names of our vehicles that are well understood and known in industry. People, you know, who drive an Equinox today will understand what an Equinox EV, what that delivers to them. But, you know, Bolt is something that has built up a lot of loyalty and equity. Mm-hmm. So can't say more because I don't discuss future product programs. But, you know, it was primarily a move from second generation to third generation, but that's a important vehicle in our portfolio.
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink, I guess. More coming of my conversation with Mary Barr later on in the program. GM shares today, should you be curious.
down about 0.5%. The major indices went the other way, 0.5%, maybe a bit more, actually, to the upside. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So here's something, a tidbit buried in the news this week of the April trade deficit. It got bigger, quite a bit bigger, the trade gap did, as we bought more stuff from overseas in April than we did in March. More cars and car parts, cell phones, household goods as well. That's not good or bad, it's just a fact. The same way my trade gap with my local supermarket goes up when I buy more food because all the kids are home from college. But the share of those imports that we were buying from overseas that came from China went down to the lowest level they've been at since 2006. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab takes stock of how U.S. trade with China has changed.
China is a producing powerhouse. Of all those ring lights and sweatpants and home gym equipment we desperately craved during the pandemic, a lot of which, remember, got stuck on container ships. Ishwar Prasad is a professor of trade policy at Cornell.
Practically every manufacturer who has relied on lean and mean global supply chains now is much more worried about the resilience of those supply chains.
They want to diversify their suppliers in case of public health crises, natural disasters, and war. Plus, rising tensions with China represent an extra risk.
Manufacturers and retailers don't want to be exposed to the risks that geopolitical tensions with China, or just basic trade tensions, might lead to disruption.
So companies have shifted to Vietnam and Thailand for cheap apparel and footwear, and Mexico for its proximity to the U.S. But Chinese imports aren't going to disappear anytime soon. David Dollar is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
The Chinese have definitely locked up a lot of the lithium supply around the world, and they've got a lot of the patents involved in the production of batteries. So that gives them a leg up in the electric vehicle market.
Meanwhile, China's also been maturing as an economy, shifting its export focus to different and more valuable things, says Susan Aronson, a professor of international affairs at George Washington University.
As countries develop, right, they tend to export more services. And so China had this deliberate plan to move up that value chain.
Yeah, we're importing less from China overall. And yeah, you might not see the words made in China on as many tags these days. But that's partly because you can't sew a label onto software, e-commerce, and AI. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And frankly, people love their trucks.
Yes, they do. More Mary Barra straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lifted 168 points today, 0.5%, 33,833. The NASDAQ increased 133 points, 1%, 13,238. The S&P 500 added 26 points, about 0.6%, 42.93 there. The CEO of the video game retailer GameStop, Matt Furlong, is out. Shares thus plummeted almost 18%. That's the deepest plunge since it became a meme stock in 2021. Seems like a long time ago, doesn't it? Man, checking in with some other sellers of games and gaming equipment. Best Buy fell 0.4% today. Walmart up 1.4%. Amazon climbed 2.5%. Did you know, by the way, that American consumers spent $56.6 billion on video games in 2022? That's according to the Entertainment Software Association and consumer data analyst NPD Group. We've been talking electricity and electric vehicles, so let's do some energy companies, shall we? Duke Energy, headquartered in North Carolina, added about 0.4%. So did Virginia-based Dominion Energy. American Electric Power, based in Ohio, improved 0.1%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Back we go now to the conversation I had on Tuesday with GM CEO Mary Barra. She's trying to move this country's biggest car maker into the world of electric vehicles. Remember, she has promised a 100% emissions-free lineup by 2035, and that is a goal General Motors is going to need some help to hit. Here you go.
Can we talk IRA and infrastructure and this idea? You and all other EV makers are dependent on an infrastructure that develops to support those cars, specifically charging stations across the country. And as a brand new EV owner myself, sadly for you, not a GM car, it's a little challenging out there, getting increasingly challenging. You can pick up the phone and call the President of the United States, right? You are one of those people. You are. I mean, come on, right? But I guess if you call them and said, Mr. President, we need more help, how confident are you that the government would be responsive to your needs? Because,
well,
go ahead. Sorry.
I think the government and the administration is very committed to an all EV future. And I think it's a little too soon to ask for more help, because if you think about what was in the bipartisan infrastructure bill, there was money specifically designated for charging infrastructure. And the states have written proposals, and that money, I believe, is starting to flow. So, you know, I talk about RAMP a lot.
Yeah.
I think we're going to see that happen now as that money starts to be deployed to build out the charging infrastructure. I think that's one important component. But I think you've also heard other people are starting to understand the opportunity when you hear a Walmart or a 7-Eleven, they're going to invest in charging stations. And you think about it, if you go grocery shopping, I don't know about you, but when I'm in the grocery store, it seems like I never get out of there less than, you know, 40, 45 minutes.
Yeah.
That becomes a perfect location to charge.
Yeah. Yes, it absolutely is. And I'm glad you raised that, because I go to my local Piggly Wiggly and there are four 150 kilowatt hour charging stations, and they're always full. And it takes 20, 25 minutes to get yourself from 15-ish% to 80% of the battery. And it's a real disincentive for public charging stations, right? I mean, people have EVs. I phrased that the wrong way. People who have EVs say, yes, I can charge in these public stations. But really, the fact is they're always full.
But again, we're in the first turn of the race.
Yeah, but I've got a car now. And all these EV owners out there that you're looking at as potential future customers for a second or third car, they have EVs now.
Well, and again, that's why we're investing. General Motors has committed $750 million to accelerate. And we're trying to pick up the spaces where, you know, there's a lot of startups working on charging infrastructure. Mm-hmm. They're going to go to dense urban environments because that's where they're going to get the payback
right.
on their investment.
Right.
Then you look at suburban. We're working with our dealers, not necessarily to put chargers at our dealers, although they are, because they're going to have EVs they
you
need
bet.
To charge on their
you
fleet.
Bet.
But they know in the local communities where are the key places, along with using OnStar data to where people move. That's another location.
Here's a better non-me-centric way to ask this question. Do you worry that the challenges of charging infrastructure will slow you down as you try to get people to buy EVs? Because people do their research and
yes.
they see that it's a problem.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. So I would say when we've surveyed consumers, if they can charge at home, and I think people are going to start to see a stronger demand, which is going to incentivize if they want to attract people to live in the, especially if it's apartments or condos, I think you're going to see a demand to add more charging capability there. But definitely we know, and that's why we're focused on charging as well as a great EV portfolio. We know it'll be a gating factor if it's not sufficient.
What keeps you up at night? I guess maybe a better question is how many things, you're laughing at me. I mean, you can't see this on the radio, but you're laughing. How many things keep you up at night, and what's the top like two?
You know, for me, it's my job to be concerned about a number of things. I would say right now what we're really focused, one is within our control, and it's making sure we have flawless execution of all the launches we're doing this year. I would say from a second, some of it which is less or not totally within our control is charging infrastructure. We're not compromising on range. If it's a truck, we're not compromising on towing. So meeting the customer where they are, that's exciting. But again, they have to know that they're going to be able to charge.
Sorry, you mentioned trucks, and I did want to bring that up because you have said you want to go in the beginning, right, with EVs, you want to go high-end and you want to go larger because that's what American customers want and that's where profitability is for you. I guess the question is, as we try to move toward a more sustainable future, of which electric vehicles are a key component, does it do us any good to have trucks that have huge battery requirements and thus huge material requirements and longer charging times, when what we really need are a bunch of smaller cars that charge quickly so people can zip around on their 15, 20-mile commutes as opposed to going 300 miles down the highway?
Well, remember, yes, we are doing trucks like the Chevy Silverado mm-hmm. and the GMC Sierra, both EVs that are coming out in the not-too-distant future, as well as building on the Hummer. We're not General Motors is a full portfolio company. We're going to have a full portfolio. But, you know, when you look at trucks, a lot of people use trucks for their livelihood. And so the other thing is, I think one of the great things about America is we don't dictate what you buy. You get to choose what you want to buy. And frankly, people love their trucks. On our battery work in this building, we're doing R&D on battery chemistry. We have a battery lab that is just over there.
Looking out the window around the corner.
And then a manufacturing processing development lab. So we're doing work to not only take the cost of chemistry down, but need less of the, you know, battery raw materials that are very expensive and hard to get.
You've been at this company 40-ish years. Mm-hmm. You've been running it for almost 10 now. Are you going to see it through this EV transition?
Well, I serve at the pleasure of the board. And so,
yes, but what's the real answer?
Well, but the real answer is this is the most exciting time in my career. Hmm. When you look at how we can change the way people move and make it more efficient and make it better for the planet. And then I do believe we can make it more efficient from a time perspective. As an engineer, it's the most exciting time I've had in my career.
Mary Barra, thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
This next piece is electrical in nature, too. As the Northeast is dealing with the downwind effects of all those Canadian wildfires, Texans are looking forward to hotter-than-average temperatures this summer. And as people start kicking the AC into high gear, demand on that state's electricity grid is expected to break records. This year, for the first time, Texas is going to be relying on wind and solar energy to meet that peak demand, the problem, of course, being that wind and solar are what you might call variable energy sources. So Texas has been adding batteries to its grid at a breakneck pace. From Houston, where they know a thing or two about air conditioning, Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall reports.
This is the sound of me putting some strain on Texas's electrical grid. To power all the state's ACs during peak demand, coal, natural gas, and nuclear power plants can no longer provide enough energy, says Joshua Rhodes with the University of Texas at Austin. And so
we are going to be relying on some amount of wind and some amount of solar to be producing electricity during certain times of the summer.
But when the sun goes down, the wind isn't blowing and people are still cranking up those ACs.
There is a bit of a lull in renewables that batteries are great at filling.
As renewable energy has expanded in Texas, battery storage has grown about tenfold in 2 years, says Austin-based energy consultant Doug Lewin.
We're now up to just about 4,000 megawatts, roughly equal to the entire city of Austin. And to see that kind of increase in that short a time in 2 to 3 years is pretty extraordinary.
But batteries still have a long way to go, says oil and gas consultant David Blackman.
You know, I'm not a Pollyanna about all this stuff.
He says batteries today can't hold a charge when the power's out for more than a few hours, like when the Texas grid failed during a 2021 winter storm.
You need capacity that will provide electricity, as we saw in Winter Storm Uri, for days.
He says that technology exists, but implementing it will take time and money. In Houston, I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
The This final note on the way out today, in which I am obliged to remind you once again that two consecutive quarters of a shrinking economy do not, here at least, mean a recession has arrived. Europe, though, is different. Eurostat, their statistical agency, said today the Eurozone has now had those two consecutive quarters of economic shrinkage. Also, and relevant, the American economy is now almost 5.5% bigger than it was in the before times. The Eurozone economy, just over 2% bigger. Here is your moment of economic context on the way out today. Amy Scott sent me this one this morning. New real estate data out from CoreLogic that shows homeowners who are still paying on a mortgage, that's about 63% of homes in this economy, they lost equity in those homes last year on a year-over-year basis for the first time since 2012. Not a whole lot of money, on average $5,400, but still, not nothing. John Buckley, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. Amir Babawe is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.